Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Wednesday, September 22nd. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. First, this forecast for the Siouxland area. Pleasant with plenty of sunshine for today, with low winds and a high of 72 degrees, and tonight, clear with a low going all the way down to 44 degrees. And now these local news stories. Lawmakers face deadline. Written by Grant Schulte for the Associated Press from Lincoln, Nebraska. The top leader of Nebraska's legislature warned Tuesday that he will end the special session convened to draw new congressional and legislative maps if lawmakers fail to advance both measures by Saturday, a move that would likely delay the state's May 2022 primary election. Speaker of the legislature, Mike Hilgers, said he'd prefer to approve all of the redistricting maps in the current special session, but the Republican senator added that he's not going to continue if lawmakers keep failing to reach an agreement. Lawmakers remained at an impasse on Tuesday over how to redraw Nebraska's congressional and legislative maps to adjust for population losses in rural areas and gains around Omaha and Lincoln. Republicans hold a majority in the one-house nonpartisan legislature, but don't have enough votes to overcome a filibuster led by Democrats and a few moderate Republicans, who argue that the maps are drawn to make it harder for them to win. Both measures have stalled in recent days, forcing lawmakers to start the process again. Hilgers said he doesn't want to waste the time of senators or the public if no one can compromise. The situation is unprecedented, he said, given the late release of population data from the U.S. Census Bureau because of the coronavirus pandemic, and the fact that lawmakers have less time to reach a deal on district maps than they would in a regular session. I certainly want to get it done now, but I also want to get it right, Hilger said. If we have one delayed election to get these right for the next 10 years, then that's a price I'm willing to pay. Nebraska Secretary of State Bob Evnen said delaying the once-a-decade ritual would force county election officials to wait longer before they could start drawing precinct-level maps to fit within the new political boundaries. Aspiring candidates who want to run for office would encounter delays as well, because the window for them to file would get pushed back beyond its January 5th opening. Evnen, a Republican, said it would be far better for the state if lawmakers completed their work this week. Lawmakers did give first-round approval Tuesday to new district maps for Nebraska's Supreme Court justices and members of the Nebraska Public Service Commission. But Hilger said he'll still end the session unless all of the maps pending before lawmakers have advanced through a first-round vote on Saturday. Ending the special session without any new maps would delay the decision until the 2022 session, which starts in January. Hilger said it would almost certainly delay the state's May primary election for U.S. House, legislative, and local races. The next presidential and U.S. Senate primaries won't be until 2024. The Nebraska Supreme Court and Public Service Commission maps advanced fairly easily on Tuesday, although some rural senators raised concerns about the growing physical size of rural districts. They said they were particularly worried about the five-member commission, which regulates industries, including broadband, a major priority in remote areas with poor service. I am concerned that without fair representation on the Public Service Commission across the state, we will continue to lose out on opportunities to grow Nebraska, said Senator Lynn Walz of Fremont. Former Speaker Mike Flood said some rural commission members may have the hardest job in Nebraska politics because they represent the interests of such a huge area. Under the maps that advanced on Tuesday, two members would represent 82 of Nebraska's 93 counties, while the remaining three would cover the other 11, including the Omaha and Lincoln areas. Flood said he'd like to see the commission expanded from 5 members to 7. For the state Supreme Court, lawmakers approved a map that would give one justice more than half of the state. Six of the court's seven justices represent specific areas of the state, while the court's chief justice serves as an at-large member. Diamond in the Rough, written by Dolly A. Butts for the Sioux City Journal in Sioux City. Delbert Christensen describes Sioux City's Hubbard Park as a diamond that's a little bit rough. Christensen and his fellow Sioux City Fast Pitch Softball Association board members, along with their support staff, are working to revitalize the more than 81-year-old softball stadium and 93-year-old park at 2800 Jones Street. It's got good bones, but there's some work that needs to be done, said Christensen, who estimates that Hubbard Park needs some $300,000 worth of repairs and upgrades, including concrete work, paint, and fencing. He said replacing the field lighting alone will cost around $180,000. If the Hubbard Park Softball Stadium is named to the National Register of Historic Places, the restoration project will become eligible for historic tax credits and associated grants. Grandview Park's Music Pavilion received the designation in 2011. On Monday, by voting in favor of their consent agenda, Sioux City Council members approved a resolution authorizing the submission of an application for a certified local government grant to the State Historic Preservation Office to support the stadium's nomination. Christensen said the nomination process is expected to take at least 2 years. In the meantime, the association's board and its support staff are doing what they can to improve the ballpark with the proceeds from sign sales. Steve Haig, that's H-A-U-G-E, vice president of the association, said Christensen has put in countless hours cleaning up the park, which, in mid-July, had eye-level weeds growing behind the fencing in right field. "We all love the ballpark," Haig said. "We've all done as much as we can to help out." Pete Sandman, the association's president, grew up half a block from the park. As a child, he watched games there and served as a bat boy. Eventually, he played in the league with people he considered his heroes. "If we fix it, they will come. We think teams will want to play here because there's no venue like this that you can play at or watch a game at," he said. Hubbard Park opened as a city park in 1928. A year later, the city of Sioux City granted land for a baseball and softball field. Then, in the late 1930s, the concrete stadium seating, concession stand, dugouts, lighting, and natural turf were constructed as a Works Progress Administration, or WPA, project. The WPA, which was renamed the Works Project Administration in 1939, was an American New Deal agency that employed millions of job seekers to carry out public works projects. Some 4,000 people jammed the stadium on July 15, 1940, for the first two games of the softball season, which marked the dedication of the new facility, according to a Journal File photo. Christensen said the stands were only built to handle 2,500 people. Over the years, the ballpark has fielded more than 30 inductees to the Iowa Amateur Softball Association, Hall of Fame, and several world championship teams out of Sioux City. "It's a unique venue just because of the layout and everything," Christensen said. "In some respects, in the fast-pitch softball world, at least in the Midwest, this is our equivalent of Wrigley Field and Fenway Park." Christensen said Hubbard Park is one of a small handful of existing, functional fast-pitch softball parks in the country. He said it has a national reputation in the men's fast-pitch softball world. "You can go from California to New York State. You'll find somebody who's either heard of it or played here," he said. Thousands didn't just flock to the ballpark for games. Christensen recalled just as many people being drawn to the park twice during the 1980s to view a traveling Vietnam Veterans Memorial. "The park got shut down a week each time they set it up in the outfield. There were thousands of people that came through here to see that. It was probably one of the park's finest moments," he said. The ballpark's popularity began to dwindle after Penn Corp Park was built near the airport in 1983, according to Christensen. But unlike Hubbard Park Softball Stadium, Penn Corp Park is no longer standing. For the last 20 years, Haig said Hubbard Park Softball Stadium has been typically used as a practice facility. It recently hosted a Briarcliff University softball intra-squad doubleheader and was used by Little League teams for tryouts. "We'd like to turn it into 100% games," he said, "not just practice, but games." Sandman said the group's long-term goal also consists of making the park family-friendly. He said he envisions playground equipment and a small diamond for kids to play on during the games. "Parents can sit up there and they can watch the kids on the playground, and they can watch the game at the same time," he said. However, Christensen, Sandman, and Haig said they aren't waiting for the National Register of Historic Places designation to be awarded before bringing games back to the stadium. Christensen said a Siouxland Women's Fast Pitch Softball League is expected to begin playing at the park next spring. He said the group also hopes to bring an NCAA Division I softball game to the park in the next couple of years. "We have to put up a portable outfield fence with shorter dimensions, but is the place going to be playable?" "Absolutely," he said. Council okays $200,000 for Visitors Bureau, written by Dolly A. Butts for the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. The Sioux City Council voted Monday in a split decision to approve a letter of understanding to authorize payments totaling $200,000 to the Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau so that the Bureau can continue to recruit new events and promote Sioux City as a destination for tourists, conventions, and sporting events. The city will make two $100,000 payments to the Sioux City Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau, or the SCRCVB, on October 1st of 2021 and 2022. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott, who cast the lone no vote, said he doesn't want to bind next year's council to $100,000. Councilmen Alex Waters and Dan Moore are up for re-election, while Councilman Pete Gretkin has chosen not to run for a third term. "I know you're going to feel like I'm not supporting your organization. That couldn't be further from the truth. It's just how we fund it. That's my problem," Scott said. In August 2020, the Sioux City Council unanimously approved a Memorandum of Understanding to authorize quarterly $25,000 contributions to the SCRCVB for 1 year. The SCRCVB is primarily funded through a 1.65% lodging fee paid by guests at hotels in Sioux City, South Sioux City, North Sioux City, and Dakota Dunes that have opted in. The fee is in addition to the 7% hotel-motel tax collected on all rooms in Sioux City. Half of that 7% tax is currently earmarked for tourism purposes, while the other half goes to the city's general fund. Tim Savona, Spectra general manager and an SCRCVB board member, said 12 or 13 hotels have signed up and that the Bureau is collecting money actively from just a little bit over half of those. Before the vote, Scott said he's not inclined to overfund something when the money didn't all get used before. "The SCRCVB spent $40,000 less, it looks to me, than what we proposed. Then why should we overfund this as well?" Scott said. Savona noted that the Bureau recently hired an executive director, Christy Franz, and is expected to begin the search for a second person in the next 30 to 60 days. Ron Bauer, the Bureau's first hire who came on board in January as destination manager for tourism, resigned his position. "This budget cycle, we'll actually have two full-time employees where we're now offering benefits as well. Previously, we weren't doing that," Savona said. "We had one employee at a manager level instead of a director level. Right there are two examples that we see some significant expense popping up as we continue to grow." Savona also noted that the SCRCVB currently has more than $30,000 allocated to event commitments. He said the Bureau previously helped bring two events to town at two different properties and has written commitments with three or four more events that are coming in early 2022. "I don't know why we would use tax dollars for this when it seems to me we could use COVID funds," Scott said. If this doesn't help hotels and motels and restaurants in this community that suffered dramatically, then we should close it down today. Finance Director Teresa Fitch said the COVID relief funding cannot be used for the SCRCVB because the services that it offers were not in place prior to the pandemic. The Bureau adopted its bylaws in late 2019. Local leaders refocused their tourism events after Sioux City eliminated the city department that oversaw not only tourism, but also the Tyson Events Center and the Convention Center. The change occurred after the city hired Spectra, a Philadelphia-based venue management firm, to run the Tyson 3 years ago. The Convention and Visitors Bureau Board manages the new CVB, while the Events Facilities Advisory Board continues to oversee the city-owned venues. New redistricting panels split along party lines, written by David A. Leib for the Associated Press. When voters in some states created new commissions to handle the politically thorny process of redistricting, the hope was that the bipartisan panelists could work together to draw new voting districts free of partisan gerrymandering. Instead, cooperation has proved elusive. In New York, Ohio, and Virginia, commissions meeting for the first time this year have splintered into partisan camps to craft competing redistricting maps based on 2020 census data. The divisions have disappointed some activists who supported the reforms and highlighted how difficult it can be to purge politics from the once-a-decade process of realigning boundaries for U.S. House and state legislative seats. As a result, the new state House and Senate districts in Republican-led Ohio will still favor the GOP. Democrats who control New York could still draw maps as they wish, and a potential stalemate in Virginia could eventually kick the process to the courts. It's probably predictable that this is sort of how it's panned out, said Alex Kina, a political scientist at Virginia Commonwealth University, who has analyzed redistricting and gerrymandering. Redistricting can carry significant consequences. Subtle changes in district lines can solidify a majority of voters for a particular party or split its opponents among multiple districts to dilute their influence. Republicans need to net just 5 seats to regain the U.S. House in the 2022 elections, which could determine the fate of President Joe Biden's remaining agenda. Throughout most of American history, redistricting has been handled by state lawmakers and governors who have an incentive to draw lines favoring their own parties. But as public attention to gerrymandering has grown in recent decades, voters in an increasing number of states have shifted the task to special commissions. Some commissions, such as those in Arizona, California, Colorado, and Michigan, consist solely of citizens who hold the final say on what maps to enact. But others, such as in Ohio and Virginia, include politicians among their members or require their maps to be submitted to the legislature for final approval, as is the case in New York, Virginia, and Utah. If New York's Democratic-led legislature rejects the work of the new commission, consisting for 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and 2 independents, then lawmakers can draft and pass their own redistricting plans. The prospects of that increased last week when Democrats and Republicans on the commission failed to agree and instead released competing versions of new maps for the U.S. House, State Senate, and State Assembly. State Republican Party Chairman Nick Langworthy blasted the Democratic maps as wildly gerrymandered and accused Democratic commissioners of refusing to compromise. State Democratic Party Chairman Jay Jacobs countered that there was no reason to bend over backwards to try and draw as many Republican seats as possible. He added, "We'll be fair, but to a point." The commission's division frustrated Jennifer Wilson, Deputy Director of the League of Women Voters of New York. The organization supported the 2014 ballot measure that created the commission and encouraged people to testify at the panel's public hearings this year. It almost feels like a slap in the face to us and to all those people who spent their time to go and submit comments, took time out of their daily lives to do that, when it's very obvious there was no regard for any of those comments, Wilson said. Frustration also is mounting in Ohio, where a commission dominated by Republican elected officials voted this past week to adopt a state legislative redistricting plan they favored. Because the plan had no Democratic support, the state constitution limits it to 4 years. Democrats on the panel called the maps unfair, but Republican Senate President Matt Huffman asserted that special interests pressured Democrats not to back a redistricting plan that could have lasted the entire next decade. Huffman said the new map likely would produce 62 Republican seats in the Ohio House and 23 in the Senate, down just a couple in each chamber from the current GOP supermajorities. Experts estimate the state's voters are more evenly divided, around 54% Republican to 46% Democratic. The partisan map came despite more than a dozen public hearings dominated by testimony from Ohio residents who said that current gerrymandered maps have left them out in the cold. Too many of us have had little say in who represents us and watched helplessly as laws are passed that hurt our families and ignore our needs. Arigi Hamad of CAIR Ohio, a civil rights organization for Muslims, testified. She said the neighborhood around the Islamic Center of Cleveland, one of the region's largest Muslim populations, is fractured into multiple congressional and statehouse districts. Because of the way that districts are drawn, our elected officials have no incentive to be receptive, responsive, or accessible to us or our concerns, she said. Authors offer reading. Trisha Kearns Sheehan and Jeannie Emmons will read from Scaled, a science fiction book they wrote under the pseudonym J.T. Ashmore. The reading will be at 7 p.m. Wednesday in the MEIS, or M-E-I-S, recital hall on Briarcliff University campus. Under the pseudonym J.T. Ashmore, Kearns Sheehan and Emmons published the science fiction trilogy Deep Skin. A part of the Phil Hay reading series, the reading is from the first book of the trilogy, Deep Skin. The two will also discuss their collaborative process. In this novel, a meteor explodes over the Midwest, and teens exposed to the fragments break out in a rash of glittering scales. As the scales spread over their bodies, they must work together to combat their self-loathing, accept their differences, and escape the forces bent on crushing them. A finalist for the 2020 Book Life Fiction Prize, the book received high praise. Kearns Sheehan is a professor of English and writing at Briarcliff University. Emmons is a Briarcliff professor emerita. Both are editors of the Briarcliff Review. Beresford man faces 41 counts, including rape. This from Elk Point, South Dakota. A tip about questionable behavior with an underage girl led to an investigation in which a Beresford, South Dakota man was arrested and charged with sexually assaulting a toddler and possessing dozens of photos and videos depicting child pornography on his cell phone. Mark Cornish, 30, is charged in the Union County Circuit Court with single counts of first-degree rape and sexual exploitation of a minor and 39 counts of possession of child pornography. A Family Dollar employee notified Beresford police on August 26th about Cornish engaging in possible child abuse or sexual assault with a 13-year-old girl at the store. According to court documents, investigators reviewing surveillance camera footage from the store observed Cornish and the girl acting flirtatious with each other. Police interviewed the girl, who told them that she had babysat Cornish's two children and that they had kissed, hugged, and cuddled at his home. She also admitted to sending him a nude photo of herself and that he had sent her photos of his penis. On August 29th, police seized Cornish's cell phone and laptop during a search of his home, where he lived with his fiancée and their two young children. Investigators searching the contents found dozens of downloaded images and videos of nude children, some engaged in sexual activity. Investigators also found a video leading them to believe Cornish's phone was used to manufacture child pornography and videotape the raping of a child inside the residence, court documents said. Court documents show Cornish was charged with sodomizing a child under age 10 and 7 counts of child molestation in Georgia in 2018. Those charges were later dropped. And now, in national news, House votes on funding bill. Reported by Lisa Mascaro and Kevin Freaking for the Associated Press from Washington, D.C. The House rushed headlong Tuesday into a vote on legislation to fund the government, suspend the federal debt limit, and provide disaster and refugee aid, forcing a showdown with Republicans who oppose the package despite the risk of a fiscal crisis. The federal government faces a shutdown if funding stops at the September 30th end of the fiscal year, midnight next Thursday. At the same time, the U.S. risks defaulting on its accumulated debt load if its borrowing limits are not waived or adjusted. The package unveiled Tuesday would provide stopgap money to keep the government funded to December 3rd and extend borrowing authority through the end of 2022. It includes $28.6 billion in disaster relief for the aftermath of Hurricane Ida and other extreme weather events, and $6.3 billion to support Afghanistan evacuees in the fallout from the end of the 20-year war. It is critical that Congress swiftly pass this legislation, said Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut, chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee, in a statement. The vote was expected Tuesday afternoon. Backed up by the White House, Democratic congressional leaders pushed ahead at a time of great uncertainty in Congress, with lawmakers already chiseling away at the $3.5 trillion price tag of President Joe Biden's broad Build Back Better agenda. Immediate attention focused on deadlines to avert deeper problems if votes to shore up government funding fail. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said he was not about to help pay off past debts when Biden was about to pile on more with a reckless tax and spending package. Since Democrats decided to go it alone, they will not get Senate Republicans' help with raising the debt limit. I've explained this clearly and consistently for over 2 months, McConnell said Monday. Even if Tuesday's vote is approved by the House, which Democrats control, it is expected to languish in the 50-50 Senate, where Democrats will be hard-pressed to find 10 Republicans to reach the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome a filibuster. The Treasury Department warned that it will soon run out of cash on hand and have to rely on incoming receipts to pay its obligations, now at $28.4 trillion. That could force the Treasury to delay or miss payments, a devastating situation. Doing so would likely precipitate a historic financial crisis, wrote Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen in the Wall Street Journal. Once a routine matter, raising the debt ceiling has become a political weapon of choice for Republicans in Washington ever since the 2011 arrival of Tea Party lawmakers who refused to allow the increase. At the time, they argued against more spending, and the standoff triggered a fiscal crisis. Echoing that strategy, McConnell is refusing to provide Republican votes, even though he also relied on Democratic votes to help raise the debt ceiling when his party had the majority. Still, some GOP senators might have a tough time voting no. Republican John Kennedy of Louisiana, whose state was battered by the hurricane and who is up for election next year, said he will likely vote for the increase if the disaster relief portion is acceptable. He added, "Because my people desperately need the help." Meanwhile, behind the scenes, Democrats are negotiating among themselves over Biden's big Build Back Better package, as the price tag likely slips to win over skeptical centrist lawmakers who view it as too much. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi implored colleagues in a letter late Monday to move swiftly toward reconciling differences ahead of deadlines to vote on the package. "This week, we must take decisive action on proceeding," Pelosi said. Biden's big initiative touches almost all aspects of Americans' lives. It would impose tax hikes on corporations and wealthy Americans earning beyond $400,000 a year and plow that money back into federal programs for young and old. It would increase and expand government health, education, and family support programs for households, children, and seniors, and boost environmental infrastructure programs to fight climate change. Biden's plan aims to not just rebuild the country after the COVID-19 crisis and economic fallout, but begin to change long-standing federal spending patterns in ways that provide more services to more Americans and attempt to level growing income inequality. With Republicans opposed to Biden's vision, Democrats have no votes to spare in the Senate and just a few votes margin in the House. Pelosi has promised a September 27th vote on a companion bill, a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill of public works projects that enjoys widespread support from both parties in the Senate, though House Republicans mostly oppose it. Even though that bipartisan bill should be an easy legislative lift, it too faces a political obstacle course. Dozens of lawmakers in the Congressional Progressive Caucus are expected to vote against it if it comes ahead of the broader Biden package. And centrists won't vote for the broader package unless they are assured the bipartisan bill will also be included. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Wednesday, September 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Rita Albrecht, 95, of Sioux City, died January 20th. Memorial service will be at September 25th at 11 a.m. at Calvary Cemetery. An open house will be at September 25th at 12:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn at 1132 Larson Park Road, Salons 1 and 2, with family present. Diane Brueggemann, 73, of Colton, South Dakota, died Sunday, September 19th. Services will be held September 23rd at 10 a.m. at the Cathedral of St. Joseph in Sioux Falls. Visitation will be September 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. at George Bloom Funeral Home and On-Site Crematory in Sioux Falls. Gary Enier Suntjens, 76, of Danbury, Iowa, passed away on Friday, September 17th at his residence. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday at the St. Mary's Catholic Church, Danbury. Father William A. McCarthy will officiate. Committal services with military rites will follow in the Danbury Catholic Cemetery of Danbury. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary at 6:45 p.m. and a vigil service at 7 on Thursday at the church. The Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Mapleton, Iowa is in charge of funeral arrangements. Condolences may be sent online to armstrongfuneral.com. Gary Enier Suntjens, the son of Andy and Ann Reamer Suntjens, was born on October 11, 1944, at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sioux City. He grew up on the family farm north of Danbury. He received his education and graduated from Danbury Catholic School. After graduation, Enier enlisted in the Army National Guard. After completing basic training, he served his country and was honorably discharged. Upon returning home, Enier commenced in farming with his father, Andy, and later took over the farming operation. On August 17, 1991, Enier was united in marriage to Nancy Parker Ashley in the St. Mary's Catholic Church of Danbury. The couple settled on the family farm north of Danbury, where Enier has been a lifelong resident. He was also a faithful life member of St. Mary's Catholic Church of Danbury, where he rarely missed a weekly church service. Enier never knew a stranger and loved the art of conversation. Enier was a big Iowa Hawkeye fan and was always up for a good bet. He enjoyed his morning coffee with the Anthon crew, wintering in Palm Springs with Nancy, had a love of classic cars and old westerns, especially Gunsmoke, and treasured every moment of being called Papa by his grandchildren. Steve Bledsoe, 83, of South Sioux City, died Tuesday, September 14th. Celebration of life will take place September 26th at 2 p.m. in South Sioux City Senior Center. Arrangements with Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Don Held, 90, of Hinton, Iowa, died Sunday, September 19th. Services will be held September 27th at 10:30 a.m. Hinton United Methodist Church. Visitation will take place September 26th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars and resumes 1 hour prior to the service time at the church. Bernard J. Bernie Schultz, 92, of Sioux City, passed away on Friday, September 17th at Regency Square in South Sioux City. A mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. on Friday at Mater Dei Pat Parish Nativity Church at 4242 Natalia Way in Sioux City. A link to view the live streaming of Bernie's mass will be available on his obituary page at meyerbroschapels.com. Entombment will follow at Calvary Cemetery Mausoleum with military honors. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. on Thursday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, with the family greeting friends from 6 to 8 p.m. There will be a rosary service at 6:30 p.m. and a vigil service at 7 p.m. that evening. Bernard John Bernie, the son of Richard and Ruth Eggers Schultz, was born July 3, 1929, in Arion, Iowa. Bernie attended country school in his early years and graduated from Denison High School in 1947. Following graduation, he went to work as a lineman for South Crawford County Rural Electric. Bernie furthered his education by attending Grandview College in Des Moines for 2 years. He then served in the United States Army and was stationed in Korea during the Korean War until his honorable discharge. On September 1, 1962, Bernie was united in marriage to Doris Houseworth Ferris in Sioux City. This union was blessed with 3 sons, and Bernie welcomed Doris's 2 sons into his life. The family made their home in Sioux City, and Bernie worked as a supervisor for the Sioux City Journal for several years. After retiring from the Journal, he started working as a Purolator carrier for 20-plus years until fully retiring. Bernie was an active member of Nativity Catholic Church. Following his open-heart surgery, he became a volunteer for Mended Hearts. In addition, he volunteered at the Sioux City Explorers baseball field, where he directed traffic. Bernie had many passions and hobbies throughout his life, including coin collecting, watching sports, golfing, and his dogs. Above all, Bernie cherished spending time with his children and grandkids. Bernie will be remembered as a kind and genuine person. Linda K. Johnson, 83, of Dakota Dunes, died Monday, September 20th. Services will be September 25th at 1 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, with burial in Logan Park Cemetery. Visitation will be September 24th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Neoma R. Zonley, 61, of Correctionville, Iowa, died Sunday, September 19th. Services will be held at a later date. Arrangements pending with Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Correctionville. Colleen Ankerstjern, 82, of Cherokee, Iowa, formerly of Peterson, Iowa, died Sunday, September 19th. Arrangements pending with Warner Funeral Home of Peterson. Laverell R. Jeannie McMahon, 78, of Ogden, Iowa, died Friday, September 17th. Services on September 24th at 2 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, with burial in Logan Park Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Ryan William Hodgson, 39, of Lamars, Iowa, passed away on Friday, September 17th at a local hospital following complications of COVID-19. Ryan's family invites you to celebrate his life at 10:30 a.m. today at Rejoice Community Church in Lamars. Reverend Mike Metten will officiate. A private family burial will follow at Nassau Township Cemetery, rural Alton, Iowa. Visitation was held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday at Rejoice Community Church. The family will be present from 5 to 7:30 p.m. with a closing prayer service and sharing of memories at 7:30 p.m. The Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's is assisting Ryan's family with arrangements. Expressions of sympathy may be directed through maurerjohnsonfh.com. Masks will be required at the visitation and services. Ryan William Hodgson, the firstborn child of Terry and Lisa Vries Hodgson, joyfully entered the world in Lamar's on March 20, 1982. He attended Lamar's Community High School, where he played tight end on the football team. After graduation in 2001, Ryan entered the auto body repair program at NITC in Sheldon, Iowa. He has always enjoyed working on his cars and tinkering with anything mechanical. After 2 years, Ryan returned to Lamar's and took a position at Vogel Paints in Orange City, Iowa, in the Vogel Traffic Services Department. He then got back to his love of automobiles, working with Charlie Clark at Harris Racing in Lamar's. When Harris Racing was sold, Ryan began working at Wells Enterprises in the freezer, where he was still working. Ryan fit 80 years of life into 39. If he wasn't snowmobiling, he was riding his Harley. He enjoyed frequent snowmobiling trips to Wyoming. If that wasn't enough, he participated in ice racing with his side-by-side. Ryan took first place this year at the Winter Games in Okoboji. He also found time to hunt and fish. He particularly enjoyed fishing trips with his uncle Mike. A big kid to the end, his most recent hobby was to race remote control cars. And just like his vehicles, he would even customize his remote controlled cars. Ryan was an avid Kansas City Chiefs football fan. Michael Dreckman, 65, of Lamar's, died Saturday, September 18th. Services will be September 24th at 10:30 a.m. at All Saints Catholic Parish, St. Joseph Church in Lamar's. Burial will be private at a later date in Calvary Cemetery in Lamar's. Visitation will be September 23rd from 3 to 7 p.m. at the church and resumes September 24th from 9:30 a.m. until service time. Arrangements are with Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. Mary Louise Nyberg, formerly Montaigne, died Tuesday, September 14th, surrounded by generations of her family. She lived in Mesa, Arizona, and was formerly a resident of Sioux City. Services are planned for 10 a.m. on Tuesday, September 28th, at All Saints Catholic Church, at 1534 North Brecker Road in Mesa, Arizona, 85205. To know Mary is to love her, and she will be dearly missed. Whether a member of her family or a maitre d' on a cruise ship, all who spent time with Mary delighted in her quick wit and admired her strong spirit. Her frankness endeared her to family and friends, and she didn't suffer fools. When her children tried to sleep in to avoid helping around the house, she would tell them, "Get up! People die in bed, you know." Her grandchildren remember she was like a ninja with her shoe. If you were misbehaving, it was off her foot and flying across the room before you knew what hit you. Her natural toughness and pragmatism were nurtured in her childhood growing up on her family's farm in Salix, Iowa, during the Great Depression. The youngest of Alma and Laverne Montaigne's 10 children, Mary shined as hardworking and daring. She rose before dawn, jumped on her horse to ride bareback and barefooted to set about her chores. The first time she wore a dress was at her father's funeral when she was just 11 years old. Mary brought humor and style to everything she did. Her joie de vivre was unmatched, and she lived life to the fullest. She loved anything flashy and classy, fur coats, beehive hairdos, sunglasses with rhinestones, casinos, especially slot machines, and cruises. She went on 16 cruises during her lifetime, visiting the Caribbean, Panama Canal, the Mediterranean, Mexican Riviera, England, Ireland, and Wales. Mary and her husband Bob loved to entertain and threw one heck of a party. And Mary was the life of the party, no matter how small or large the gathering. She raced horses and had a lead foot behind the wheel. Frank Sinatra was the soundtrack of her life. She had a lifelong love affair with all things athletic, both as a participant and a fan. She played basketball in high school in the early 1940s. Tuesday was bowling night, and as the mother of seven kids, she juggled her role as mom by making goulash for dinner before heading out the door. A point of pride for her was bowling a 299. She loved golf and played for most of her life. As a member of Morningside Country Club in Sioux City, Mary played with her lifelong friends, Lee Konospisos and Alice Marks. She loved watching football and basketball. Her great-grandchildren could count on her to know all the professional team schedules, and she was on the sideline for a good measure of her grandchildren's soccer games. Mary was a wonderful cook, and it was one of the ways she showed her love. Her family will miss her Christmas cookies, ham and bean soup, cucumber salad, turkey dressing, and Swedish meatballs. A prolific artist, she painted china, upholstered furniture, tended gardens, and sewed her daughter's Easter dresses and cross-stitched quilts for grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The only thing she couldn't do was give a home perm, although she tried many times on her generations. In her later years, she had the companionship of her daughter and roommate, Carolyn. She was always included in the activities and events of her extended family, most of whom lived just a short drive away. She read the paper every day, played solitaire, watched football, basketball, and Family Feud, and loved her dogs. She'd say, "That dog looks hungry," and share her toast and eggs with them. Mary loved her family with a pure and generous heart, and was happiest when they were all together. Mary M. Hansen, 77, of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, September 18th. There will be a visitation from 4 to 8 p.m. today, with a rosary service starting at 4 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel and a vigil service at 7 p.m. A Catholic burial service will be held at 12:30 p.m. on Thursday at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Sioux City with Father Terry Roeder, celebrant. Entombment will follow in the mausoleum at Calvary Cemetery. Mary, the daughter of Robert and Eleonora Schmidt Blackford, was born February 6, 1944, in Sioux City. She was raised in Sioux City and attended St. Boniface Grade School. Mary graduated from Helan High School. In 1964, Mary met Henry E. Hansen, and they were united in marriage on June 26, 1965, at St. Boniface Catholic Church. This union was blessed with two boys, Dan and Todd. The family made their home in Sioux City. Mary worked many years in housekeeping at Marion Health Center, currently Mercy One, retiring in 2006. In recent years, Mary and Henry made their home at the Heritage in Northern Hills. Mary was proud of her Catholic faith and was a member of Sacred Heart Catholic Church. In her younger years, she liked to bowl and was on a bowling team with her sister, Kathy. She enjoyed taking family pictures, especially at events. She had a special love of animals, particularly dogs, and loved caring for her plants. Above all, family was very important to her. Craig E. Kelly, 70, of Jefferson, South Dakota, passed away due to complications from cancer on Saturday, September 18th, at a local nursing home. A memorial service will be held at 7 p.m. today, with visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Online condolences may be made to meyerbroschapels.com. Craig was born on December 16, 1950, in Sioux City, the oldest of three children, to Beryl and Leah Langston Kelly. Craig served in the United States Air Force for 20 years and was stationed in Vietnam, California, Colorado, Germany, Oklahoma, Illinois, Italy, Ohio, and Saudi Arabia. He was united in marriage to Doretta Jocelyn on September 2, 1970, and together they had two children, Jim and Heather. In 1996, he met Nancy Hall Clay, and they were married in 2005. Together, she and her four girls joined the family. Craig was a retired math and engineering teacher and golf coach at Sergeant Bluff Luton School. She loved to golf with his son, He loved to golf with his son Jim and grandsons Austin and Ethan. He enjoyed going to car shows around Siouxland and his annual trip to the Des Moines Good Guys car show at the fairgrounds with Austin Clay and Sean Hurley. Austin and Grandpa had many adventures. Craig was a friend of Bill W. and a member of the Strollers, Good Guys, and Boy Scouts. On June 14, 2020, Craig was honored with a ceremonial honor flight at the Vietnam Memorial in South Sioux City, since they were unable to fly. The family would like to thank the VA, Hospice of Siouxland, and family and friends for all their wonderful care, support, and encouragement given to Craig. Jerry M. Ofert, 84, of Hinton, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, September 15th at a local hospital. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday at Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Larkin Chapel, located at 2320 Outer Drive North in Sioux City. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m., with a memorial service at 11 a.m. Online condolences can be made at christysmith.com. He was born in Rolka, Lithuania, on April 20, 1937, the son of Anton and Anna Ofert. The Anton Ofert family immigrated to America. They arrived at Ellis Island, New York, on May 13, 1952. His birth name in Lithuania was Adolf Ofert, which he changed to Jerry in 1958, typical of immigrants of the time. Jerry joined the U.S. Army and served from 1955 to 1961. He was proud of his military service. Jerry was united in marriage to Susan Renshaw on April 21, 1969. To this union, three children were born, Michael, Matt, and Nadine. Later in life, they parted ways. Jerry was later united in marriage to Mary Ellsworth on December 25, 1995. They enjoyed traveling and going to car shows until her death. Jerry was a trailer mechanic and painted trailers for Mark's Trailers from 1968 until his retirement. He was known as Jerry the Painter. He had a love for 50s music and enjoyed collecting and rebuilding cars and trucks, especially Ford F-100s of that era. He was a member of several car clubs and had a 1956 Ford F-100 that he showed and was very proud of. And finally, Royce E. Brown, 90, of Kingsley, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, September 15, 2021, at Happy Siesta Healthcare Center in Remsen, Iowa. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Burial will be at Kingsley Cemetery, with military rites conducted by the U.S. Army and American Legion Nash Post 140 of Kingsley. Visitation will be Friday from 5 to 7 p.m., with the family present at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Online condolences may be sent to roadfh.com. Royce was born December 12, 1930, to James W. and Iva Summers Brown in Garfield Township, rural Kingsley. He graduated from Grand Meadow High School in 1950. He received a welcome letter in 1952 inviting him to the U.S. Army, where he spent 2 years in Frankfurt, Germany. He and Shirley Pratt were married April 21, 1954, and lived on a farm in Plymouth County until they went to the nursing home. Royce farmed for 5 years before going to work at Sioux Tools and retired from there 28 years later. He and his family attended the Christian Church in Pearson, Iowa until it closed, then attended the Nazarene Church in Lamars, Iowa. He was active in both churches with singing solos, song leader, church board member, and with Bible school. Royce enjoyed woodworking and made various things for his family. He also had several flower gardens which he enjoyed working on during his free time. Royce enjoyed spending time with his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Wednesday, September 22nd. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Volcanic eruptions can affect global warming or cooling, and one of the ways we measure their impact is by looking at a lunar eclipse. To understand this strange connection, we need to know a bit about Earth's atmosphere. The lowest part, the troposphere, extends from the surface up 4 to 12 miles. It's where Earth's weather happens. The stratosphere above that is dry and less active. Dust and ash particles carried into the troposphere by volcanoes, fires, or other sources will quickly fall or be rained out. But when a large volcano erupts, it blasts ash and gas through the troposphere into the stratosphere. There, sulfur gas forms microscopic droplets of sulfuric acid. These sulfate aerosols can remain suspended for years. One way scientists measure them is by looking at lunar eclipses. If they're murky and dim, the stratosphere is clouded with aerosols. If they're bright and defined, the stratosphere is clear. Large volcanoes in the past have put up enough aerosols to reflect the sun's heat and cool the surface of Earth by as much as 1 degree Fahrenheit. But in the last two decades, the stratosphere has been remarkably clear, which has allowed more solar energy to reach Earth. Some scientists estimate this has caused half the global temperature increase seen during this period. Another example of how Earth's processes are linked in surprising and complex ways. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.